From the campus of Yale University, this is Business Talk with Jim Campbell, nationally syndicated across the country on the Biz Talk Radio Network, and coming to you from our flagship stations, Yale Radio WYBC and 1490 AM WGCH Greenwich. All talk and all business, 60 minutes of radio with leading figures from the world of business along with the business of politics and sports. Joshua Hunt is a former foreign correspondent for Reuters in Tokyo, graduate of the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism, where he was a fellow at their Center for Investigative Journalism. And Joshua's new book, University of Nike, How Corporate Cash Bought American Higher Education, and he's joining us from out west. Okay, great to have you on board. You know where I want to start, and obviously I should tell folks that University of Oregon is going to play a big role in this interview. But in a bigger picture, sort of a law of unintended consequences kind of look, tell us how the tax mania cut sort of spurred a lot of this.
Writing this book was just, it began with a series of questions. You know, first it was, okay, well, how did things get this way? You know, how did the University of Oregon end up having this very cozy relationship with Nike and its founder, Phil Knight? And, you know, you answer that question, then it just keeps going further down the rabbit hole. But basically, it all began with universities ending up with these big, you know, what we think of as the modern public research university. It grew somewhat out of the Cold War and the government funding a lot of research at a lot of different universities, right, both covertly and overtly, and helping them build up these great research departments and these, you know, faculty and researchers and so forth. And then when this when the Cold War started to taper off, universities began seeking other means of funding these departments, and a lot of that ended up being, some of that ended up being small corporate partnerships, but a lot of the funding of universities remained tax dollars. You know, it was basically a good portion of public universities was subsidized by state and federal tax dollars. Mm-hmm. With back in the 1980s, a lot of universities, the formula was basically 2/3, you know, was subsidized in some way, and 1/3 of your degree might be paid for on average by a student out of their tuition dollars. And in Oregon, earlier than most states, the taxpayers kind of flipped this by saying, okay, well, we want big, in Oregon's case, it was property taxes that conservative anti-tax activists went after. And in 1990, they narrowly passed this piece of legislation called Ballot Measure 5 in Oregon. It slashed property taxes over the course of several years. And that was where a lot of the funding for public schools in Oregon came from. And so what happened was, public universities like the University of Oregon had to compete against K-12 public schools in Oregon for a shrinking slice of the pie out of this dwindling state fund, the state general fund. In the early 1990s, they found themselves facing a tough choice, and the University of Oregon president at that time, Dave Frohnmayer, who took over as president of the school in 1994. He was sort of a born fundraiser. He'd run a nonprofit organization. He'd run for governor unsuccessfully and raised a ton of money doing both of those things. He was a former Oregon attorney general and state legislator. And so his default position for shoring up extra money was to raise it from private sources. And that's where Nike came into the picture, basically, let's get some outside money from Nike, from Phil Knight, the state's big success story in terms of corporations.
So, you know, this sort of privatization move, a lot of people, I don't think, link it to what ended up happening as we're talking about. And some of these components, you've got a huge increase in the power of the athletic department and that profile, which we'll talk about. And then you got to rely on more out-of-state students, right, to get the tuition per student up. Oregon, in this case, had an underpaid faculty, which sort of remained that way even after the riches came in, and then a greater reliance on adjuncts for further cost benefit. It's like all these moves coming out of tax cut were all really negative for the quality of Oregon in this case, other than the franchise value going up.
Yeah, and I should say the way that Dave Frohnmayer and Phil Knight, the then CEO, chairman, and co-founder of Nike, the way they built what I call the University of Nike blueprint is basically this. It's, build up the athletics facilities in order to attract better athletes, better recruits. In this case, the problem was that the University of Oregon was having trouble recruiting the best high school football players to come to college in Oregon because they all wanted to go to California where it was sunny. Oregon didn't have an indoor practice facility for its men's football team. So this is the first thing major that they asked Phil Knight for help with. They had in 1995, the Oregon Ducks had kind of a fluke trip to the Rose Bowl, 94-95. Phil Knight said, how can I help this become a more regular occurrence? They said, help us build this indoor practice facility. So that's the beginning of them building up their football program and building up the brand associated with their football program. You know, we're talking over the years, more athletics facilities, stadium renovations, Nike designing a new logo and a new brand for the school, a brand that's become very valuable in terms of licensing and merchandising now, Nike designing uniforms for the team and stuff. So from the outside, you see shiny new buildings, you see all this fancy Nike gear and uniforms, and it looks like, wow, that school must have really solved its funding problem. And while it's true that football brings in a lot of money when the team is successful in terms of TV contracts and things like that, it's not necessarily as sustainable as it looks from the outside. So, for example, there are buildings, these athletics facilities that they build, they have very high maintenance costs, annual maintenance costs, and those come out of tuition dollars that are paid for by non-student athletes who don't even really get the benefit of these facilities. This is really where the University of Oregon and these other universities have followed down this path. This is really where they're shoring up that missing taxpayer money. They're drawing in, they're recruiting more students from out of state to pay higher tuition, and they're raising tuition year after year after year after year to an absurd degree. And so it's really it's a pretty unsustainable, inefficient system because, for one thing, class sizes balloon.
Yeah.
And so you've got more students per professor. And they're not hiring at a rate commensurate with the ballooning class sizes. And when they do hire more, it's a lot more adjuncts as opposed to tenure track professors. And so, you know, academically, the university suffers, and tuition keeps going up for the students, which contributes significantly to the debt crisis, which is a huge problem. I mean, in some cases, still today, the tuition goes up by 10 or 12% over the course of 2 or 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
So imagine that you're a freshman at the University of Oregon in, say, 2014, 2015, and you're kind of barely hanging on. You know, you've come from a small town in Oregon where you've graduated from high school, and you're barely hanging on in terms of paying that tuition, paying your rent, you know, working whatever job you have to work to be there and stay in school and stay on top of things. And then say tuition goes up, as it has over the course of a couple of years, 10 or 12%. That might be the difference between you finishing school and not. And in a lot of cases, what will happen is students who are barely hanging on as freshmen end up not finishing their degrees. And so they get most of the debt and no degree to show for it. And that's a real, it's one of the saddest aspects of the current student debt crisis, I think.
Yeah, I find it very sad that Oregon did make it to the national championship under Chip Kelly, which is a huge accomplishment. But all this money that was brought in, all this notoriety, didn't translate into any academic improvement. And one of the things you say at the beginning of the book is the public land-grant universities really help people get out of the middle class or get into the middle class. And now what you just described is basically locked in or knocked down if you can't afford it. We'll talk about the buying of a university president in our second segment. And we're back with investigative journalist Josh Hunt. His book is University of Nike, How Corporate Cash Bought American Higher Education. Let me ask you this while we finish up on that on the sexual harassment rape scandal. Is it true that the players were allowed to quietly transfer after the tournament out of the university? And in fact, the Providence guy had transferred in quietly because he had a gang rape charge at Providence. And also that that you were sort of stonewalled in the freedom of information. They made you pay for stuff and things like that.
Yeah, it's true that they tried to. I mean, they tried to quietly transfer these guys. And yes, it is true that one of the players had been found responsible for a similar incident of sexual assault at Providence, not criminally but administratively. So this is one of the big things that Obama tried to push schools to do better on, which is with regards to Title IX laws. He reiterated to schools over and over again that they have a responsibility to investigate sexual assault reports administratively as soon as they receive them. Schools tend to do this thing where they say, okay, well, there's a police investigation going on, so we'll just wait and see what happens with that. One of the problems with this is a lot of time goes by, and the investigation might, be a bit colder by the time the police are done with it. Often, cases, the police, what they're hoping for when they do this, of course, is that the police will say, well, there was alcohol involved, so even though we're not saying this didn't happen, it's going to be tough to get a conviction, and so we're not going to take the case. This highlights one of the other problems with this kind of thinking in waiting to see what the police do. The administrative charge has a lower bar than beyond a reasonable doubt. It's administratively under Title IX, usually the bar is preponderance of evidence, which is a lower standard of evidence.
Mm-hmm.
So schools often, even if someone accused of rape might win at a criminal trial, they can often be found guilty under an administrative charge at the university. And that's what happened to this guy at Providence. They basically said, we find that you sexually assaulted this student who claims that you did that, and so you've got to go. Unfortunately, what they did was just quietly transfer him to Oregon. And Oregon knew this, of course. The coach knew this. They've tried denying this, but evidence shows that they knew. And they recruited him anyways. He was redshirted for the year when all this happened, and then he was part of this this other incident. And Oregon did try and handle it the same way until this police report came out, and they had to, more publicly kind of disown these guys and kick them out of the school and so forth. And they did end up transferring and. Two of them play in the NBA now. The scary thing about this to me is it makes me wonder, how often does this happen and we just never hear about it? That's concerning. That should concern us all, because a big problem with all of this is lack of transparency. Basically, a lot of people have asked me what reforms could be made to fix some of this stuff. And I tell them, well, if people just followed the rules that were in place, that would be a good start. And so, follow the Title IX laws and so forth with regards to investigating campus sexual assault. And with regards to transparency, schools and other public institutions need to be forced to follow federal and state open records laws. We have very strong public records laws in this country that in many states, you know, they vary a bit state to state. But basically, not just me as a journalist, but you and all your listeners as citizens have rights to records which are produced by public institutions receiving public money. A public university is, of course, a public institution. And so things like emails sent between administrators, contracts with Nike and other apparel makers, things like this are all public records. And schools have a limited right to redact things like students' name or information about students' grades or their medical history or things like this. But beyond that, beyond blacking those things out when they release emails or other records, they're supposed to give us more or less what we want. And at the University of Oregon, they treat the Office of Public Records as though we're an arm of the PR department.
Yeah.
And they obfuscate records as well as they can, and they try and keep from the public and from journalists any records that might cast the university in a bad light or that might reveal a little too much about its relationship with Nike and so on and so forth.
And didn't they try and charge you like $10,000 even to get copies of stuff?
Well, this is one of the ways that they try and hide records and keep public records from public scrutiny. So first they'll try redacting a bunch of stuff and giving you these records that look like classified NSA documents or something. I mean, everything's blacked out. If they can't find a reasonable excuse to do that, or even an unreasonable one, if it would just look too bad for them to do that, then another trick that they'll do is they'll say, okay, this document needs to be reviewed by our lawyers. They'll send it to the university's general counsel. And because because open records laws allow for them to charge a reasonable amount of money for the preparation of records. So, for example, if a employee of the school making $10 per hour needs to spend, 2 hours making the copies or finding the records or so forth, they can ask that you pay that $20. They can also waive that fee if the information that you're requesting is in the public interest. If it's something that might be a benefit for the public to know. And in my case, when I asked for records regarding the handling of this rape case, which is very much in the public's interest to know, whether or not a rape has occurred in its community. In my case, they had these lawyers review the records, and then they said, okay, well, these guys, before they worked for us, they were high-priced corporate lawyers, so we're going to have them apply their corporate rate to the number of hours that it took them to read through the documents carefully and slowly. And so we'll give you these records if you pay us $9,000.
Yeah.
And so, of course, that's going to dissuade any reporter from asking for those records. And, we appealed that. Unfortunately, we lost our appeal with the district attorney, Patty Perlow, in Lane County. She decided that they were in the right in denying us those records. I wonder if she read my book and saw how that Office of Public Records is operated. I wonder if she would reconsider now. That's one of the more flagrant abuses of the law that I claim the university makes.
Now, let's talk a little bit about Phil Knight. And, from the outside, he looks like a tremendous benefactor, but really ruthless in dealing with the president who's had kids with this rare disease. And you can talk about him sort of turning it on and off the spigot to that foundation. And talk how he was hands-on on, you know, projects on campus.
Yeah. Well, look, you know, one thing I tell people is if you look back, you know, I had to look very closely at Phil Knight's life and his career for this book. And the guy doesn't lose. There's a reason he's Phil Knight. There's a reason that Nike is the brand that it is.
Mm-hmm.
And that is that this guy does not walk away with the bad end of a deal, ever. He's a very smart, shrewd business person. And so when I talk about his philanthropy in the book, I claim that he's really making investments in things. He's not really giving away money. And I think if you look at many billionaires, you'll find that's probably the case. There's a book out now called Winners Take All that looks at billionaire philanthropy from this particular perspective. That's basically the long and short of Phil Knight as a businessman. You know, he's very shrewd. He makes investments. He doesn't just give money away. He's very strategic. And so from the beginning with his relationship with the University of Oregon, he's approached it as a business person would. So for one example of that is don't pay for everything. You pay enough to get your name on the building, and you make someone else pay for the rest. You make the school fine. So, you know, if it's a $90 million athletics facility that you're building, you don't pay all $90 million. You pay, you know, 50 or 60 or whatever it takes to get your name on the thing and to have control of the project. And then you leave the school to make up the difference, which they sometimes do by resorting to asking the state legislator to issue these state bonds, which then end up costing taxpayers a bit of money and end up coming with these hefty interest payments. So that's another way in which these things don't always turn out to be a great deal for the university or for the state. Another unique thing about Phil Knight or someone like him brings to the table in terms of their dealings with a university is that these kind of guys, they don't like dealing with things the way that a public institution has to deal with things. You know, when a university does something, it's an arm of the state, basically. The people who work there are state employees. And so there's a certain level of bureaucracy. And for example, when they build something on campus, they have to deal a lot with you know, unions, with community members, stakeholders. You know, there's a lot of oversight, which is, for Phil Knight, just a lot of unnecessary hoops to jump through, you know? This is someone who made his fortune by coloring outside the lines a little bit, you know, by going to China or Vietnam or South Korea to do manufacturing because it was cheaper and because he didn't have to deal with worry about unions that way. He didn't have to deal with he didn't have to worry about certain laws and things like that we have to deal with in America. And so his approach at the University of Oregon was pretty similar, you know. So what they often do with building projects is he will start an LLC, and then he will have the school transfer or lease the land to him. And then he will, you know, sometimes even have a lot of involvement in having the plans drawn up, and then just basically taking over the building project until it's finished and handing it back to the school as a finished product. And so thereby relieving the school of having to jump through all these hoops that a public institution really ought to have to jump through, if you think about it. I mean, so this is one of the things that is problematic about the University of Nike blueprint, is that it privatizes important aspects of a public institution. And back in the late 1990s, very early on in this relationship between Phil Knight and the University of Oregon and Nike, he began investing strategically in the University of Oregon president as well.
Yeah.
He, pretty quietly, he began contributing $40,000 a year to the University of Oregon president's salary as this kind of salary supplement. Now, I claim it would be outrageous today if you opened up the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal and found out that the CEO of Google was supplementing the president of MIT's salary, in, you know, with this extra bit of money, $40,000, $50,000, whatever dollars. It would be a scandal, and it should be a scandal, but for some reason it attracted little attention in Oregon, this very unusual arrangement. Even more unusual was the fact that Phil Knight became the largest donor towards a nonprofit organization called the Fanconi Anemia Research Fund. The Fanconi Anemia Research Fund was dedicated to finding a cure for the rare genetic disorder Fanconi Anemia, which had already taken the lives of two of Dave Frohnmayer's daughters by this time, and it would later take the life of his last living daughter at that time. So Phil Knight secretly gives millions of dollars to this organization each year. And in 2000, when this huge anti-sweatshop protest movement sweeps campuses across America until it makes its way to the University of Oregon, Dave Frohnmayer, University of Oregon president, is put in a position where he has to sign on to an agreement with the Worker Rights Consortium, this human rights and labor rights group, which is highly critical of Nike, which is basically the bane of Nike's existence at this point. I mean, it's easy to forget how effective this protest movement was back then. It had a it had an effect on Nike's image and on its bottom line. And so it really incensed Phil Knight when this happened. And in the year 2000, well, let me just put it this way without telling the whole story exactly as it is in the book. In the year 1999, Phil Knight, the tax records show, gave $2 million to the Fanconi Anemia Research Fund. In the year 2000, he gave $2 million to Fanconi Anemia Research Fund. In 1999 and 2001, he gives $2 million each of these years. In the year 2000, he gives nothing. And this is the year in which he and Dave Frohnmayer had a big conflict. And my book lays out exactly what went down, exactly what the conflict was, and how they resolved it so that Phil Knight could once again become the Fanconi Anemia Research Fund's number one benefactor.
Now, another consequence is, and this is will lead into why you first started looking at all this, seems to be that as the power and the profile of the athletic department increases and the caliber of the athletes, sexual assault and DWI and all kinds of other things seem to go up commensurately. And so you got involved with when there was allegations of rape by three basketball players at Oregon, one of whom had, I think, had transferred from Providence. And talk a little bit about how you got involved and how Oregon essentially covered it up.
Yeah, so this is back in the spring of 2014. I was in Portland, Oregon at the time and working as a freelance reporter for the New York Times. And I woke up one day and found this this police report had been released by the Eugene Police Department describing a very graphic sexual assault that had been reported by a freshman at the University of Oregon. This girl and her father who helped report the crime, you know, said that these three basketball players had raped her at a house party just a short walking distance from Hayward Field in Eugene. And the thing that caught my eye was the fact that the police report was 2 months old by that point. And I'd heard nothing about it. No one had heard anything about it. And these guys had been on the team and had participated in NCAA tournament play. And so I got an assignment from my editor at the Times, Jason Stallman, who sent me to Eugene to find out what was going on. You know, did they cover this up? And I left Eugene after writing two short stories for the New York Times, I left Eugene with a lot of unanswered questions. You know, what I found was a school that did not seem to be obeying public records laws. It was really trying to obscure how the school's administrators and public relations officials had handled the case. It seemed to me that they were treating the issue like a public relations problem, you know, and it seemed to me that they were not following a lot of the laws.
Final segment coming up, turning universities into sports franchises. Yeah, it's our final national segment with Josh Hunt investigating the corporatization of universities. So the University of Oregon essentially becomes a sports franchise and has its own brand identity along with Nike. You're talking about University of Maryland having a model like this now, and big bucks paid to Michigan and Texas. A school I love, Notre Dame, is also close with Under Armour. Do you come out that that this is a net negative, the tail wagging the dog, et cetera?
You know, it's worth remembering that we don't necessarily know what would have happened to the University of Oregon had they not come up with this arrangement, you know, had Phil Knight not come along. I can't say, as a journalist who deals in facts, I can't say that the University of Oregon would have been worse off or better off if this hadn't happened, because at the end of the day, it was the taxpayers who first failed the university.
Mm-hmm.
What I can say is that whether you're a college football or basketball supporter or not, whether you think this money in college athletics is a good thing or not, I think we should all be able to agree on the fact that there should be greater transparency and greater accountability. I mean, look, there's corruption scandals. There's these corruption charges. We've got college athletes dying during practices. We've got this huge problem with campus sexual assault.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got a system where I think it's pretty hard to make a case that all of these guys are getting a great education, you know. And so we've got to stop fooling ourselves. We've got to stop pretending, first of all, that these big athletic programs are sustainable, that they pay for themselves, and that they benefit the institution as a whole, as opposed to just a small number of administrators and coaches who make a ton of money.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the apparel companies who get a huge amount of advertising out of this, even the athletes themselves. I mean, I talk in the book about this decision back in 1898 to not pay college athletes. And the decision was basically made by all these Ivy League schools. They were the ones who decided that it was ungentlemanly to pay college athletes. I know it's sort of a controversial idea that, you know, should we or shouldn't we pay college athletes? I don't think it should be that controversial of an idea, because this notion that it would wreck the purity of the sport, I mean, how pure is the sport at this point if there's so much money involved in it, if everyone's getting paid but the player, who is essentially a walking billboard for Nike or Adidas or Under Armour? Good or bad or ugly, I think we need to get a lot more honest with ourselves about what we're supporting when we support one of these teams or one of these programs. And we need to make sure that there's a lot more accountability, particularly for apparel makers and these corporate partners, because they're the ones who benefit most. And the rules essentially exist because of them and for them. I mean, the whole reason that we have these all-school deals is because Nike was so good at essentially buying the school kind of off the books. You know, back in the your listeners may already know this part of the story already, but back in the late 1970s, Nike hired this guy, Sonny Vaccaro, in 77, I believe he came on board. And because he had founded this game called the Dapper Dan Classic that connected top high school talent. It was kind of an all-star game for top high school basketball talent in Pennsylvania. You know, it was basically a showcase for college coaches who could then cut backroom deals to get the players they wanted, and Vaccaro would take his cut. Well, Nike hired him to use those relationships to get Nike shoes on the feet of college basketball players. At that time, you could not make an all-school deal. You could not cut a deal so that schools were required to have their athletes in Nike shoes or Adidas shoes. And so Vaccaro told Nike, you got to buy the coaches. That's the loophole. Hmm. You pay the coach $5,000 or $10,000 a year. You say, I'll give you enough shoes for all the players on your team. And if you make sure that they wear them, you'll get the same money or better next year. It was this sort of winking kind of deal, but it worked. And it worked so well that by 1986, some basketball coaches are making $100,000 a year from Nike, in some cases more than they're getting paid by their schools to do their actual job. And so the NCAA changes the rules, essentially because administrators were tired of getting cut out of the profits, right? They're saying, why are the coaches making all this money and Nike's making all this money and we're not getting anything? So that's the beginning of these all-school deals, which eventually became a kind of, just like the shoe money, just like these backroom deals that what they called shoe money, mm-hmm. of Vaccaro buying the basketball coaches, the all-school deals became this kind of escalating arms race, you know, between the schools. And that's where you get into the era of million-dollar, you know, coaches with million-dollar salaries and stuff, because the TV money just doesn't stop flowing when it comes to college sports. It gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And it's gotten so big now that at every school, these athletics programs are their own little fiefdoms. It's just very dangerous to have that much money flowing into segments of the university and to not have total transparency. And I mean, we almost need independent monitors or ombudsmen or something to go in and make sure things are okay and that laws are being followed. Because when there's that much money, again, this is where people start thinking about the brand instead of the well-being of students. And so you have to wonder what role it plays in not just scandals like Jordan McNair and hampering campus sexual assault investigations. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, look at what happened at Penn State. Look at what happened in Michigan with this gymnastics coach, you know. These are things that people looked the other way on because they didn't want to damage the brand. They didn't want to damage the legacy. They didn't want to stop the flow of money. And that's very, very dangerous. And you can see all the different ways that it causes harm to, you know, these poor young girls who were molested by their gymnastics coaches, these, you know, poor young boys who were molested at Penn State, these students who report campus sexual assault and never get any justice for it, and so on and so forth. And the tragic case of, you know, this young, healthy athlete, 19 years old, dying after a football practice. Very tragic stuff.
And that's a great way to end it. The book is a great expose, as well as an indictment in many ways. Thanks to Josh Hunt, the University of Nike, How Corporate Cash Bought American Higher Education.